Peace be with you. Friends, the language of apocalypticism has for centuries both fascinated us and disconcerted us. What do I mean now by apocalypticism? I mean all this language in the Bible about the end of the world. Oh, we're fascinated by it. Go on the web, go on the internet, put in the book of Revelation. Up will come millions of references. The Bible gives us, of course, plenty of ammunition in this regard. In both the Old Testament and the New, there's lots of vivid talk about the end of the world, involving plagues and famines, earthquakes, the yawning of graves, the falling of stars, etc., etc. Well, what does all of it mean, as it both terrifies us and fascinates us? Is this meant as a literal prediction of what will happen as the time-space continuum comes to a close? Is it merely symbolic language? Is it more political than cosmological? Does it belong to an age which has happily enough passed away? Does it really speak to us in any meaningful way today? Well, these are all the questions that swirl around these apocalyptic texts. I'm talking about it today because two of our readings, now at the very end of the liturgical year, are very apocalyptic in tone. We hear first from the book of Daniel, one of the great apocalyptic texts in the Old Testament. And then our gospel is taken from the 13th chapter of Mark, a particularly apocalyptic section of that gospel. We do indeed hear, as we listen to these readings, of graves opening up, of a time of unsurpassed distress, the darkening of the moon and the sun, the coming of the angels, the shaking of the powers of heaven. All of that is talked about. Well, what do we make of it? What do we say about it? Can I suggest just one mode of interpretation? Christians, throughout the Bible, God is engaged in operations of cleansing and restoring. Think of the flood, the time of Noah, and the restoration that followed. The floodwaters destroyed the old world. And then God commenced the rebuilding of a new one. Think of the plagues that tormented the Pharaoh in Egypt and the escape of Israel that followed. What was God doing but cleansing, cleaning out an old world and preparing the way for a new one? Think of the war of conquest. When the Israelites entered the promised land, what were they doing? Think of the destruction of Jericho, a cleansing of the ways of sin. Think of the Babylonian captivity and the restoration of the temple that followed. How did the prophets read that? They read it as God using a foreign nation, the Babylonians, to cleanse sinful Israel and thereby to prepare the way for a new world. See, sometimes on the biblical telling, evil becomes so concentrated, so pervasive, that God has no choice but to clean it out. The way a cancer, perhaps, is removed from an organism. A doctor might look at the situation and say, the only way we can deal with this problem is to cut the cancer out. Or the way a dilapidated building is torn down. Sometimes you can restore a building, you can gussy it up, fix it up. Other times you say, look, this thing is such a wreck, all we can do is tear it down. In both cases, you're cleansing and purifying for the sake of something new. Well, God now, using various agents and secondary causes, like a flood, like plagues, like the witness of Noah, like foreign nations, effects this work of cleansing. But then, always, he commences to rebuild. Never, ever, when interpreting the Bible, see this apocalyptic language as simply God falling into an angry snit. God just having a bad day, God visiting arbitrarily punishment on the world. God's ways are never capricious, they're never arbitrary. And God's punishment is always for the sake of renewal. There's always a cleansing operation going on. Now, against that Old Testament background, let's look at Jesus. The New Testament authors, Paul, the Gospel writers, John, the rest of them, they saw Jesus as the full expression of this divine cleansing operation. Somehow, in Him, and especially through His death and resurrection, an apocalyptic cleansing was happening, and a rebuilding operation was underway. Look, at the concentration of evil on display in the New Testament, in the Jewish authorities, in the scribes and Pharisees, in the Roman occupying power, in the various tax collectors and collaborators, the whole congeries of those who conspire, betray, deny, surrender to corruption, beat and spit and shake their heads, all up and down the New Testament, culminating in the Passion narratives, we can see, as it were, all of human dysfunction laid out before us. And what does Jesus do? He fights. Yes, He's the Davidic king. He's the Davidic Messiah. He's come to fight. And yes, He's a warrior. But He does it, as I've often said, not in the usual way. Jesus takes all of this violence, all this stupidity, all of this corruption, and He absorbs it, as it were, on the cross. Takes it on, and then swallows it up in the ever greater divine mercy. When Jesus says, "Father, forgive them, they know not what they do," He's addressing not just those who are immediately crucifying Him. He's addressing all of those and all of us who have risen up against Him. He fights violence through nonviolence. He fights hatred through love. He fights stupidity through the divine intelligence. He fights the lack of compassion with an overwhelming compassion. How do we know that He won? Because on the third day, He rose from the dead through the power of the Spirit. Listen, if Jesus had not been raised, the old world would still be firmly in place. No cleansing would have occurred. You cross the Roman Empire, you end up on a Roman cross. You mess with the powers that be, and they will crush you. You try to fight violence with nonviolence, and you're out of your mind. Friends, if Jesus had stayed in His grave, all of that would remain definitively the case. Nothing would have been cleansed. Nothing new would have appeared. But when He rose through the power of the Spirit, when He appeared to those who had betrayed and denied and run from Him and said shalom, a word of forgiveness and love, at that moment, friends, all the stars fell from the sky. At that moment, the moon was darkened, and so was the sun. At that moment, all the powers fell. Now, what am I talking about? I'm using now the language of apocalypticism to signal the end of the old world. You see, Jesus risen from the dead turns everything upside down. All the landmarks are destroyed. All the ways that we've typically navigated in the world are now lost. They're turned upside down. The world that we thought we knew, we now realize we do not know. Think for a second now of those symbols of stars, sun, and moon. For an ancient person, those were not just heavenly bodies, not just beautiful things to look at in the sky. They were the means of navigation. You were navigating by sea at night, even making your way on land. That's how you were oriented, by looking at these heavenly lights. You see what the resurrection did? It disoriented everybody. The usual way of thinking, the usual way of acting, it don't work anymore. Everything's been turned upside down. We've lost our way. The old world is being cleansed. It's passing away. Now, love really is more powerful than hatred. Now, nonviolence is displayed as the way of God. Now, life is really more powerful than death. And therefore, we are in a place where the streets have no name, where we just don't quite know where we're going. And that's good news. Again, don't read this apocalyptic language as simply terrible. Yes, it does signal the end of something. The world of sin. Oh, the cleansing operation anticipated in Noah's flood, anticipated in the plagues of Egypt, God's just getting warmed up. The final cleansing operation happened when his son fought this apocalyptic battle on the cross and put an end to the old world. Let me close with this. You know what that word apocalyptic means literally? It means the unveiling. Kalypso in Greek means a veil. Apocalypsis, taking away the veil. The old world is destroyed. Yes. That's what famine and plague and flood and earthquake mean. But now, a veil has been removed. And a whole new way of seeing, imagining, thinking, and being has emerged. You know that great scene in Mark's Gospel when at the death of Jesus, the temple, the veil in the temple was torn in two from top to bottom. Something was unveiled. Something was revealed. What's revealed is the new world that God is holding out to us. What's our challenge? Now live in it. Live in this new world that has been unveiled to us after the destruction of the old world. That's what these texts mean, I think. And we celebrate them at every Mass, at every Eucharist, whenever we read the sacred scriptures. Live in the new world that God has unveiled to you. And God bless you.